नमस्ते. सो वी अराइव एट चैप्टर 10 ऑफ एसेज ऑन द गीता, द योगा ऑफ द इंटेलिजेंट विल, विच इज द लास्ट पार्ट ऑफ चैप्टर 2 ऑफ द गीता. सो चैप्टर 2 ऑफ द गीता इज एसेंशियली इनटू कैन बी डिवाइडेड इनटू दीज थ्री पार्ट्स, दो दे आर वन सिंगल फ्लो. एंड इट बिगिंस विद Arjun's extreme dejection because he is undergoing a state of moral crisis, intellectual crisis, emotional crisis, and at its bottom, a spiritual crisis. It is an intellectual crisis because he is caught up in the state wherein his mind is not able to give him the right principle of action, what he should do and what he should not do. It's an emotional crisis because his heart is caught up between, on one side, his own brothers, his own people, on the other side, his own cousins, his own people. So it's an emotional crisis because either ways he is going to lose some. And it's also a moral crisis because he does not know what is the right thing to do. So he's in a state of bewildered intelligence. Arjun faces this crisis because though he is an action-oriented person, yet he is fundamentally a sattvic nature. So this is the combination. So the Gita is meant for those who believe in action, who are into action, but at the same time they don't want to just engage blindly in action. They want to understand what I should do and what I should not do. In other words, the Gita is not really meant for a monk leading a life in a remote monastery, because that's not his dilemma. He is not in the world. At the same time, there are those who believe in simply acting out of the gut. They don't care about understanding what should be done, what should not be done. The Gita is not really meant for them either. But there are a good number of sample of humanity, hopefully the larger number, who do want to understand, who believe in action, but they don't know what is the right thing to do. And even if they believe, there are times when they enter into a state of crisis, when they are totally in a state of confusion. So the Gita is not only liberates them from the crisis, but it also shows the light, the principle through which we can guide our whole life. So how does the Gita liberate from crisis? The first part of the chapter 2 is when Arjun finally is in a state of dejection. He puts down the bow and says, I am going to take sannyas. I can't fight this battle. It's better that they even kill me, take away my kingdom, rather than fight a war which is going to be fratricidal, which is going to kill my own people. And then we know that how Shri Krishna rebukes him, and he gives something very interesting. He first tells him, you are a kshatriya and you must follow your kshatriya dharma. So in very nutshell, there has to be somebody who is adhikari for the yoga of the Gita. The adhikari for the yoga of the Gita are not runaways or castaway. Adhikari for the yoga of the Gita, he is somebody who is moving through life, and yet he has to live according to the highest standard. So this is where Shri Krishna sets the record straight, and it's a lesson to all of us that first we must practice whatever our innermost truth is. Act according to that. Then comes the higher light. If we simply discard all these things and suddenly say, I want to be in Brahma sthiti, then it doesn't work out. At least not for the Gita, because Gita shows us a path which leads through life. So this is the first step where he says, Arjun, if you look at it purely from the point of view of what your dharma is, you must fight. Why? Because you are a kshatriya. It's your duty, both by your own nature and as per your present situation, you must stand up for what is right, what is true and what is beautiful. And you should be fearless in that. If you die, the doors of the beyond will open for you, they will greet you. And if you win, you will conquer the kingdom which you rightfully deserve. So this is the kind of logic which is given to him. And then he addresses that other part of the logic with regard to he is afraid that, you know, or rather he is worried that people will die. Here they will die, there they will die, and here Shri Krishna brings in the Sankhya element of the yoga. That this is what you are describing is part of a cycle of nature. But as far as the self is concerned, it doesn't die. So he explains this self very beautifully. Actually, many people believe that chapter 2 of the Gita is enough. Many people stop there because it can actually lead you, if practiced sincerely, it can lead us to what is known as Brahma Gyan and the Brahma Nirvan. Chapter 2, it is sufficient. But Gita takes us much, much, much further. So how does it start? It says, look here, there is the mutable nature and there is the immutable self. This immutable self is neither born nor dies. And it gives very beautiful description. Many of us have heard these slokas, Nainam Chiddanti Shastrani, Nainam Dehati Pavaka. So it is, that is, the fire cannot burn it. The waters cannot, make it wet or destroy it. The winds cannot dry it. And such is the nature of the true self. So you are grieving for that which is always there. So these people who are in front of you, you yourself, always you have been there and you will always be there. That is how the true self is described in the Sankhya. And then he gives him another logic, that if you use your discerning intelligence and look at life as it is, then it is also true. Jatasya dhruvasya mrityu. And whatever is born will die and whatever is dead will come back again. This is the cycle of nature. So whether you take the standpoint which is spiritual or you take the standpoint of nature, there is no cause for grieving. Grieving comes. That he will explain little later why grieving comes. But he tells him that either which way, you at this point of time, you are called upon to your duty, fight. And this is not a time to grieve and this is not the moment when you should succumb to these emotions of the heart. After this, Sri Krishna starts the third part, which is where the actual practice of the Gita starts. Starts with what is normally called as a Buddhi Yoga or also Sankhya Yoga. And he uses the word intelligent will. So what really is yoga? Yoga is in very, very one sentence, turning of our natural members towards the divine. Very simply. Mind turned towards the divine or God or the truth, call it whatever, is a mind which is moving towards yoga. When it finds the truth, the light, then it is in yoga. Heart and its emotions turning towards God is yoga, bhakti yoga. The first one is jnana yoga. Jnana yoga, you turn toward that which is immutable. The ultimate truth, bedrock of truth. Heart, bhakti yoga is when the emotions turn toward the divine. So normally they are turned toward the world seeking satisfaction in this or that person, in this or that relation. When they turn toward the divine, seeking the fulfillment of all our heart's wishes and wants, then it engages in yoga. Ultimately, it is a heart which is established in yoga. When it is established in yoga, there is joy, there is ananda, there is sweetness, love naturally within such a heart. Similarly, there is a will which is operating in works, various motives. This will, when it turns, instead of turning towards selfish, egoistic satisfaction, it turns towards the divine to serve the divine. Then it's a will striving towards yoga. But here, so that is karma yoga. Now here, Sri Aurobindo is using the word, as Sri Krishna uses the word, intelligent will, which is about buddhi. So what is this intelligent will? First of all, if you look at creation, everywhere we'll see a hidden intelligence at work. And we'll also see a will which is operating even in the atom, in the form of choices. But it's given to mechanical working. It's a mechanical intelligence and a mechanical will, but perfect within its own limits. Now, in human beings, this intelligent will takes the form of understanding and then acting. The sign of a person in whom buddhi is awakening. So there are two kinds of human beings with regard to buddhi. Buddhi is the intelligent will. One who act first, justify later. Or who are simply busy justifying their actions. And people who want to justify can justify based on anything and everything. They can use the Gita, they can use Sri Aurobindo and the mother, they can use the scriptures to justify their actions. So that is a misuse of the buddhi. But the right function of buddhi is to understand. It must first understand why things are the way they are, why am I doing whatever I am doing. And then when you understand, you act. So it is intelligent will. They are always together. Right understanding followed by right action. But ordinarily, the intelligent will is given to all kinds of things in the world. And that intelligence is called a discursive intelligence. Discursive intelligence is an intelligence which is turned towards understanding everything except the divine. And discursive will is will, which is turned towards achieving this, that, everything except the divine. Or we want to say one immutable truth. So that is called as discursive intelligence in the language of the Gita. Bahu shakhana, like a tree, you know, in many sides it's branching over. So from day to night, if we look at our, what all we want to understand, what all we want to achieve and strive for, we can understand how our buddhi is completely scattered in 100 things. And therefore, we miss the goal. Whereas the first thing about buddhi, intelligent will, is turn it inward and outward. So the Gita describes there are two kinds of movements of intelligence will. One, it is turned outward and downward. Let's take an example. Somebody criticizes. So we spend so much time and energy trying to understand why this person has criticized you. What a waste of time. Somebody once asked me, why somebody has done what they have done? So I had a one-line answer, because he is a human being. All human beings do this. What is new about it? Sri Aurobindo says that Ishwarchandra Vidyasagar has passed a final judgment on human nature. When he says that I have not done anything wrong to him, why is he criticizing me? And Sri Aurobindo says he passed a final judgment and said, that is why he is criticizing you. This, by the way, very, very profound sentence. There is something called as a guilt mentality in people. If you do too much good to people, then they start feeling a burden, because you are doing so much. It's known in psychology. It's not my mind's creation. So they start feeling burdened. They can't pay back. They are limited. So what do? They sometimes start becoming overcritical of you, because that's the only way they can get rid of this guilt. That he is not doing any favor. He is doing nothing, basically. So, this is a kind of mentality which begins to develop, that why somebody said this, why somebody did this, how does it matter? And we want to learn everything external. So, instead of that, the buddhi is occupied in downward things, how I can make more money, how I can win more friends, how I can get more likes, or how I can get this or that. That is called buddhi turned outward and downward. And Sri Krishna says very clearly, such a buddhi, which is in many, many branching out in many directions, not to speak of gossip and waste of time when people meet, does not achieve the divine. What is needed is buddhi turned inward and upward. So other day somebody was asking me the difference between world and God. Well, God is in the world and the world is in God. So it's not about being world and God. The difference is in the general worldly attitude and attitude which is towards God. You can be in the ashram and yet your attitude may be very, very worldly. And you can be outside and yet your attitude may be turned towards God. In yoga, yoganishtha. And that attitude the Gita describes first as vyavasayitmak. Why vyavasay? Vyavasay is normally one of the words used for business. So, it's a very interesting word, though the Gita uses it in its original Sanskrit sense. So, what is business like? A businessman is focused on his goal. You know, he'll talk to you very nicely, but at the end of the day, a product is a product. He's very business-like. So this approach towards where you are one-pointed towards God, your intelligence, your will, your actions are directed, turned towards finding God, seeking God, and having found, manifest Him, express Him, that is called buddhi, buddhi yoga. So first thing he explains to us is, what is buddhi yoga? And then, quite naturally, Arjun asks that, okay, if buddhi yoga is there, then what about action? Because you are saying that my intelligence should be turned inward and upward. So, why are you asking me to act? He says, that's where the catch lies. Action done without use of buddhi is inferior to buddhi. Use of buddhi. But it's not about abandoning action. Doing action in a state of buddhi is superior. So he brings in the yoga element we have talked about. So a person whose intelligence is turned inward and upward, why would he act? How should he act? For what purpose? Because ordinarily we act out of desires or attachment. So why should he act? So that's where Sri Krishna gives that profound, well-known Mahavak. One of the Mahavak is Karmanye Vadhikaraste Mahafaleshu Kadachinam. Ma karma falhetu bhur mate sangotsva karmani. He says, you must act. Action is given to you. But don't act with an eye on fruits, because fruits bind us. It's very interesting to see. It's a very wonderful psychology. And Sri Aurobindo goes on to say, if you practice just this one thing, action without fruits, it can take us very far and liberate us. Everything that we do. And fruits are not always outward, that I'll get money out of it. That's very crude and vulgar. Fruit may be eyeing on a particular chair. Fruit may be to please a human being. Now when we are doing this to please a human being, what is happening? God's willingness is slowly getting deviated. When we are doing something to win name and fame, oh, people will praise me, then my action will definitely become first subtly distorted and later on grossly distorted. I'll start wearing a dress which would impress people. I'll start speaking a language that will impress people. I'll start quoting from scriptures to impress people, as Ravan used to do. He would quote from the scripture because people get maha-impressed. Oh my God, he knows so much Sanskrit. So everything will become slowly artificial and deviated from the original truth. So he says that do the action because you have a right to it. It is given to you. Here, right to it means that it is given to you. There is a reason why it is given to you, which he will explain later. But when you do the action, your inner state should be one of a tyagi. So he distinguishes between tyag and sannyas. Sannyas is people who run away from life because they are afraid of life. Why? Because if they act, they will get attached. So they run away from money because they will get attached. They run away from relationship because they will get attached. They run away from everything because they are afraid of attachment. So that's a sannyasi. But tyagi means inwardly you are not seeking any of the fruits that will come through your action. And when we don't seek any such fruits, you are freed in a big way from all that becomes a bondage when we act. Because when we act, attachments can come in, frustrations can come in, all kinds of things may come in and we get bound. So he gives us the beautiful psychology of what binds us. What binds us is not action. What binds us is the attitude behind the action. What binds us is the motive behind the action. That's why, as I keep saying in Sanatana Dharma, there is a lot of stress on motive, not on the action as such. Action is there, important, but motive is so important. If your motive is false, if your motive is selfish, you may be a very religious person, you may be religiously visiting the temple or wherever. You may be even outwardly doing, you know, somebody once told me, you know, there is, people may have heard in many of these gurudwaras, you have this service which is called as Jute Ki Seva. So, meaning thereby that there are people who pick up your shoes and keep it. And some of the big people who, you know, so-called VIPs. So, they will sometimes pick up the Juta Ka Seva. Why? Because to show, see, and then they'll talk about it. And then people will talk, oh, he's such a big man. He's doing Jute Ki Seva. Means there is, what is it? It's a another way to get name. That's such a big man. Now I have all the names. I want a name for myself in terms of spiritual life also. So I'm doing Jute Ki Seva. So these things can be so subtle. I am doing mother's work. I am an instrument. All these things can be so subtle. I am writing a book on mother. Are these 100 things, giving talks. So these subtle forms of ego, which can completely bind us. So one has to understand that if we have these things, we are eyeing on any fruit, even a fruit in other worlds. So Shri Krishna says there are people who read the Vedas, who do all the rituals of the Vedas, but they are doing it mainly to win earthly goods or goods in paradise. So he says they are deluded. So much he says, you know, there are people who may read the Vedas, they remember the Vedas, they do all the rituals, but why do they do the rituals? To get progeny, to get house, to get this or that. He says they are deluded. Shri Krishna uses that word. He is not speaking against the truth of the Vedas. He says they pick up those portions of the Veda which suit their convenience. So this is how he described that these are deluded souls, but the one who has realized the self, for him, all scriptures spoken or written, their worth is, their value is almost like somebody who is surrounded by the ocean and a jug full of water is in his hands. The scriptures are like the jug full of water. Whereas if you realize the truth within, the self within, the divine within, you are surrounded by the ocean. So this is how he leads Arjun. So Arjun naturally asks, but how do I recognize him? He's a pragmatic man. He says, tell me somebody, how do I recognize who is a person who is seated in the self, who is a true jnani? Because now he says, you have confused me even more. Up till now, I would just see somebody who has written 108 times, who's, you know, people call him, oh, you are a great yogi. So I used to believe that they are great yogis and I do pranam. How do I know that somebody is truly a yogi who is in the state of Brahmic sthiti or not? So he has heard all kinds of things. Either they are always with closed eyes. So he starts explaining. See, Krishna doesn't give any outward signs. Neither his dress, because he has asked how does he walk, how does he speak, and how do we recognize him. So Shri Krishna gives no outward sign. He gives all inner signs. So what is the inner sign of somebody who is in a state of Brahmic sthiti, in a state of Brahma Nirvana? So he says desires have passed away from him. Now it's an inner sign. How would you know outwardly? He will not say, I don't want this or I want this. He neither wants nor does not want. Because when you say, that means you are practicing sannyas. He is neither wanting it, nor he is shunning it. So it is an inner sign. He is in a state of desirelessness. Second, he is always full of peace and joy. Why? Because no desires. Desires make us restless. So when desires go, always if we observe it psychologically, it is desires which make us restless. Then he is freed from Vit, Rag, Bhay, Krodha. Oh, this person is favorite to me. I'll be partial. This person, I don't like his face. So whatever the person says, I will say no. Why? Because I just say I don't like. As simple as that. Vit, Rag, Bhay, Krodha. He is afraid of nothing and nobody. And he is not, he never gets angry. So why then he describes an interesting psychology about anger. So, very beautiful. This is, chapter 2 is masterpiece. I mean, everything is masterpiece. So he says, how do we fall? So he says that first we desire. And sannyasis shun the objects from the senses. But the mind is still roving around it. So it's not enough that we shun from the outward contact, because mind is still in it. So we may shun it outwardly, but mind is moving. So they are desiring certain objects, calm. So because of kama, desires, they are in a state of inner, they are vichlit, in a state of inner restlessness. And whatever the mind is dwelling upon, if we don't get it, next step is krodha. So first there is kama. I want things to happen this way. And I believe it is the right thing. And when it doesn't happen, then there is krodha. Then krodha leads to sammoha, cloudedness of mind. Krodhat bhavati sammoha. And when there is clouded state of mind, the person falls from the memory of the truth, true self. And then there is complete beautiful. So how are we to get rid of it? Reverse process. Don't rush at the objects because the senses are rushing after them. Oh, this is so good, I must have it. Oh, that is wonderful, I must have it. Don't rush at that. Apply your mind. Apply the buddhi. Then Still, he says, even if you have applied the buddhi and restrained the senses, it's not enough, because mind will come up and start taking joy in them and go through joy and sorrow, even though nothing is visible outside. So he says the mind should be seated and turned toward the eternal, mat paraha. The mind should be settled in the divine, in the supreme. So here we see that he brings something new which is not there in the Sankhya. He brings something new which is not there in the traditional scriptures, that mind should be turned toward the divine. Senses, instead of rushing by the senses, apply buddhi. So buddhi will tell you that don't just rush into it. Your effort should be in another direction. And then the buddhi itself must be absorbed in the supreme. And if we can do that, and Sri Krishna gives an easy way, he says, fixed in me. Supreme means what? So, mind needs an object. It says, okay, give me something concrete. So, fixed in me. We can say fixed in Ma. So, substitute the letter E with A. Okay? So, and that reminds us, by the way, since you had mentioned before we read, monk, you added EY, monkey. But you know, you have to just remove one word, O with A. It becomes man key. Monkey is the key to man. Okay. Some people actually say monkey, monkey. They don't use the word monkey. Monkey. So M-A-N, man, monkey is the key to man. And man is the key to the Superman. And that's what Sri Aurobindo is. When man fixes his attention to the superconscient, to the supreme, man becomes the Superman. So this is what we see. Chapter 2, he says that somebody who is in a state of Brahma Nirvana, desires will enter into him. But even as they enter, they will enter into him as rivers enter into an ocean. The ocean doesn't say, no, I don't want this river. I don't want that river. Oh, you are dirtying me. Oh, you are spoiling me. No, it receives everything. Everything comes and it absorbs everything. That is the state of somebody who is in this state of Brahma Nirvana. And that is true samadhi, which one has even while waking. When one has expelled desire, when the mind is fixed in the divine, that is samadhi. And not that where one has closed the eyes and is having some wonderful experience. So that's how Sri Krishna describes. One more practice he gives here, which is very interesting. He gives an image. He gives the image of the tortoise. So when you see when a tortoise is attacked, it's a very good image, huh, psychologically. What does the tortoise do? He can't hit back. Poor fellow is equipped with nothing, yet it is equipped with the capacity to withdraw into the shell. All that it does is it withdraws into the shell. And if you see the videos of, you know, when tortoise is attacked by, you know, some of even these predators, suddenly it withdraws. Now, they try to hit the shell, everything, but nothing happens. This fellow just remains inside. Until they get totally frustrated and give up. So it's a very simple practice. When people insult you, criticize you, throw things at you, don't rush out to greet them. How dare you? Don't start rolling your sleeves. Because then what are you doing? You are, instead of withdrawing, you are reaching out to them. And they want that. So that they can have a grip on you and gobble you up. Instead, withdraw inside in the silence or in the quietude into the divine. When you withdraw into the quietude of the divine, nothing can harm you. It will try touching the shell a little bit. But when it sees you don't give up, they will go away. So plenty of things to remember and practice. That's what we see in chapter 2. And we'll just read a few passages. And Shobindu himself says, look at, you know, sometimes Shobindu's sentences are so touching. He starts chapter 10 by this interesting sentence. I have had to deviate in the last two essays and to drag the reader with me into the arid tracts of metaphysical dogma. however cursorily and with a very insufficient and superficial treatment, so that we might understand why the Gita follows the peculiar line of development it has taken. So many beautiful things appear in just this one sentence. First, he says, I have had to. He is sitting with us, before us, and he is teaching us the Gita. So he's saying, like a perfect gentleman, mother says he's a perfect gentleman, he says, I'm sorry. I had to take you through the dry dust of philosophy. Shobindu is not someone who wants to teach us philosophy. He wants to teach us yoga. And there is a world of difference. And philosophy, those arid tracks, he himself says, oh, this Sankhya, oh, this yoga, try to understand metaphysical dogma. That's not what Gita is about. Gita is about action. So he says, I had to take my readers. I had no choice. And yet I have done it quickly, superficially, cursorily, but it was needed. And then he says that Gita's last great suggestion is surrender. That comes at the end of chapter 2, just passingly, matparaha, with his mind fixed into me. But he says, see how the Gita develops. If you have not practiced Buddhi Yoga and you just say, I am given to you, O Lord, it is just a word. Because we are given to the senses. I may say that mother, I give myself to you. But actually, whatever senses are driving me to, I am rushing toward that. So basically, I am not practicing yoga. I am just using some words. That's why you will see Gita develops towards bhakti. Toward the end. First there is buddhi yoga, then karma yoga, then comes bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga is ultimate. Bhakti yogi is somebody who has given himself entirely. He may start with emotions, but entirely to the divine. But have we really? Are we not giving ourselves to the senses? Are we not giving ourselves to mental discursiveness? First, we must gather all this, and then we have to give to the divine. So he reveals to us all that. And then he says something very interesting on page 94. Just one sentence in between. My yoga will free you from all bondage of the soul to its works. Karma bandhanam prahasyasi. What an assurance. And then it gives an even greater assurance. Because Arjun says it is very difficult to practice all these things. He says, svalpamasya dharmasya trayato bhayato mahat. Even if you practice a little of this yoga, you will be liberated from great fear. Where does fear come from? All from results. Fear of failure, fear of death, fear of this, fear of the 100 fears. Because we are thinking the result will be a failure. Result will be this. But if we do things only dedicating them to the divine, how can there be any fear? So you see, even a little of this practice will free you from all fear, much fear. And now what Shrivinda is saying is not only about Gita, it's applicable to his yoga as much. You are afraid of many things, afraid of sin, afraid of suffering, afraid of hell and punishment, afraid of God, afraid of this world, afraid of the hereafter. What a bold statement. What is it that you are not afraid of at this moment? You, the Aryan fighter, the world's chief hero. But this is the great fear that besieges humanity. It's fear in a world of whose true nature it is ignorant. Fear is because of the ignorance of the true nature of the world. Of a God whose true being also is not seen and whose cosmic purpose it does not understand. Therefore, it has filled in with his human idea. God is there sitting only to judge us, to condemn us into eternal hell, or to reward us with goodies on earth. So we don't understand the ways of God. My yoga will deliver you from the great fear. And even a little of it will bring deliverance. When you, and I take it, when Shobindra is using the word my yoga, he is speaking as much about his yoga. Shobindra's yoga extends upon the Gita's yoga. It develops over and above. When you have once set out on this path, you will find that no step is lost. However imperfect practice, doesn't matter. He understands the motive inside. If the motive is to find God, it doesn't matter. We may be stumbling. We may not know how to concentrate. We may be just sitting for 10 minutes. But the time is not wasted because that was our intent. We could not meditate. It's okay. But we wanted to meditate. That's what it counts to start with. So no step is lost. Every least movement will be a gain. So I often say, you know, when people go to ashram, come from outside and they visit, I say, you know, from the time you thought about and booked the ticket, your meter chalu hai. Because it's a step. Why did you do all this? Because you want to reach there. Why do you want to reach there? You want to reach at the samadhi. And frankly, this is the truth. It's not just that when you go to samadhi, some people say, oh, the journey was so terrible. Doesn't matter. Every step taken toward the divine, however imperfect, counts. So there is, of course, I've spoken about the story of Draupadi and many others. The fact that you are, Chutnaranji's experience, I was narrating, he was very in a state of restlessness. He was himself narrating to me, young boy. And one day he hears a voice, go to Kali Mandir. He goes to Kali Mandir near his village. And he's turning and twisting. He doesn't understand the cause of his restlessness. And hears a voice, write to the mother of Pondicherry. Later on, he would say humorously, he says, there is only one God who speaks in English. So he wrote the letter. Now, before the letter has been posted, he started seeing a rose in front of him, which continued till the letter went, reply came. Nalnida wrote on behalf of the ashram. The mother says, come. But all through that, he would see this rose in front of him. The deathless rose, the psychic in its own way. So you see, it is, he went much later because he has to book the tickets. He only written a letter. He has had the urge, but the contact is established. So no step, because you are wanting to contact the divine. It is said that if you take one step, 70 steps the divine takes. Today I'm not going to rush because now it's the practice of yoga. Maybe this chapter in one or two sittings or whatever, because otherwise, no point. Every least movement will be a gain. You will find there is no obstacle that can balk you of your advance. A bold and absolute promise, and one to which the fearful and hesitating mind, beset and stumbling in all its paths, cannot easily lend an assured trust. Really, when long back, I remember people, once I asked somebody, had come to Bikaner, and I asked him, so Shubhendu, basically we have to use our will primarily and apply, the Buddhi Yoga period is going on. But he says, yes, but Mother Shubhendu primarily speaks of surrender. So anyway, that was one. Then Chotnaranji, he says, hum to bolte hai maa ka naam lo, take mother's name. Now it sounds in the beginning very difficult. Really, we just have to call mother's name. But slowly you understand that that is the supreme wisdom. Mother says at one point, above all these so-called complications of the human mind, there stands the luminous simplicity of the grace ready to act, if only we allow it to do so. So he says it's very difficult for people to believe in this, that really it is an assurance, nor is the large and full truth of it apparent, unless with these first words of the message of the Gita we read also the last. So this is the first word, Svalpamasya Dharmasya. What is the last word? Abandon all laws of conduct and take refuge in me alone. I will deliver you from all sin and evil. Do not grieve. So from here comes the exposition where he speaks about two types of intelligence. One which is wrong intelligence, wrong will. And the other is right intelligence, right will. We may use the word use of these things. So the last passage on this page 95. There are, says the Gita, two types of intelligence in human being. We may say two turnings of the intelligence, essentially. The first is concentrated, poised, one, homogeneous, directed singly towards the truth. Unity is its characteristic, concentrated fixity is its very being. Why unity? Because in everything it is seeking the truth. It's a unified intelligence. Whatever work it is doing, it is seeking the truth, the divine. And then it speaks about the other. In the other, there is no single will. And Mother uses the word contradictory wills. She says, why people don't find the divine? Because they are full of contradictory wills. They want the divine, but they also want many other things besides. And so it doesn't work out like that. Ultimately, at some point, one has to reach that point where we want the divine and the divine alone. That is what we have to arrive at. In the other, there is no single will, no unified intelligence, but only an endless number of ideas, many branching, coursing about. That is to say, in this or that direction. It's called Bahu Shakha Nam, as opposed to Vyavsayitma, concentrated intelligence fixed in the one. Bahu Shakha Nam. They're reading too many books, discussing too many ideas. Sometimes I wonder, when even after turning to Shrivinda and the mother, people go to this sannyasi, that yogi, want to. You can do it for the play of the mind, but this is not something which will lead us anywhere. If you are not sure of the path, stay out of it. Search for it. When you find the path, enter into it, go headlong. That's how I'd put it. Because that will only create confusion in the mind. Doubts, confusions, all kinds of things. That is to say, in this or that direction, in pursuit of the desires which are offered to it by life and by the environment. And the greatest desire is mukti. Finally, somebody will open a door and I'll be free from all suffering. Buddhi, the word used, means properly speaking, the mental power of understanding. So this is how Sri Aurobindo takes us through the Buddhi Yoga and gives us the whole psychology behind it. And how there is a whole hierarchy of the senses, then the mind. So senses pick up the data, and then the mind dwells upon it. Then the mind acts. It doesn't refer to buddhi, no? Because buddhi will tell, no. It rather uses the buddhi to justify. I have asked, he has given sanction. And then what does the buddhi do? The mind do? It rushes after the objects. And when it doesn't get the object, the mind still dwells. Oh my, I wish. That is how it operates. And it drags the buddhi into it. But he says instead we should, it starts trying to understand how to get that object. It uses the intelligence in that direction. But instead the mind should turn toward the buddhi and the buddhi into yoga with the divine. That's the whole thing which he, and he takes a dig at those who are Vedvadins. People say in the Vedas you have, you know, for everything, you say this mantra and you get this. You do this, you do it. Even with mother, people form that relation. It's not about it being right or wrong. It simply means Sri Krishna doesn't condemn it. He says you are deluded. You are roaming around in the same cycle. Whereas you should be free in action. By doing this, you may get the objects of your desire, but you will be more bound neck deep into it. So there are masters who will do magic and miracle and give you your objects of desire. But you are still a bound person. With the mother, she may give you the object of desire and the experience of it and free you from it. Compressed course, crash course. So someone asked Sri Aurobindo, why does the divine give the object of desires? He says, so that you learn from experience. So, therefore, it is the upward and inward orientation of the intelligent will, page 99, beginning of the passage, that we must resolutely choose with a settled concentration and perseverance. Vyavasaya. So this is what is important, practice. And this has nothing to do with sitting in a chair or on palti, you know, in this asana or that asana. It's an inward concentrated state. And you will feel when you come in contact with such a person. How much ever you may try to drag the person into a discursive thing, the person will not be dragged. Not because somebody is trying to do something, because you are inwardly in a state of concentrated intelligence, unified intelligence. So such is the state, whatever the person may be doing, wherever he may be going. So we see the next passage starting with, it is not an external asceticism, the physical renunciation of the objects of sense that I am teaching, suggests Krishna. Immediately to avoid a misunderstanding which is likely at once to arise. So he's not teaching that you must not go here, not do this, no. Inwardly you are in a state which is turned toward the divine. I think I have given this example of how once someone went to a mall in Delhi and from the ashramite would never go, hardly gone out, never gone out in this way. And suddenly got very nervous. No, mall is a, I was accompanying. I don't know. No, let's go, let's go. Let's go back to the ashram. I said, okay, Delhi ashram, huh? Delhi, mall in Delhi. Okay, first sit here, got a chair, made the person sit. I said, drink some water. Okay, now see Krishna everywhere. This is your job description. I said, practice. Anyways, you can't rush back to the ashram, you have no choice. See Krishna everywhere. See, this is, it's not sinking. It is rather seeing the divine in all things and everywhere, which is being commanded. Though here it is, he's not using the word divine, that comes later. But at least learn to be in the world, but not of the world. Why? Because the mind is concentrated on the divine. That's what he is teaching us. And then he says, however, the mind does not become free till it is in contact, finally comes in contact with the Param, the soul, the divine. And then he says, self-discipline is not easy. Nothing can be done without discipline. That's how the mother puts it. So even the sage, page 100, certainly self-discipline, self-control is never easy. The passage starts with that. All intelligent human beings know that they must exercise some control over themselves. And nothing is more common than this advice to control the senses. But ordinarily it is only advised imperfectly and practiced imperfectly in the most limited and insufficient fashion. Even, however, the sage, the man of clear, wise and discerning soul, who really labors to acquire complete self-mastery, finds himself hurried and carried away by the senses. It happens. It's a process. It's not today. Okay, some people say, from tomorrow I am going to fast. Then it ends up that only tomorrow I am going to fast. And then I'll eat like a glutton. Like the famous story of somebody in the ashram who would say, are you giving up smoking, cigarette? It is very easy. I do it every day. Every evening I quit the cigarette. Rest is understandable. So it is not that. This kind of, he says, it's a long process. It doesn't come easily. That's why he's saying swalpamasya dharmasya, even if you try it. And then he gives the whole process. Why the mind constantly falls. It falls because it continues to dwell on the objects. Why it dwells on the object? Because it is not dwelling on the eternal. The only way you can make it stop dwelling on the objects is by giving it the supreme object. If we want that, we'll suddenly make it stop. Well, Buddha could do it, that's true. But even for him, the object is permanent. Some object has to be there. But for what did he give as a truth to the disciples? He said, Buddham sharanam gacchami, Sangham sharanam gacchami, Dharmam sharanam gacchami. The mind has to dwell upon some object. Give it the supreme as object and then it will stop. Page 101. This cannot be done perfectly by the act of the intelligence itself, by merely mental self-discipline. It can only be done by yoga with something which is higher than itself. Yoga means to unite with something higher. And in which calm and self-mastery are inherent. When we turn toward the divine, for the divine, peace, self-mastery, joy are inherent. And this yoga can only be arrived at its success by devoting, by consecrating, by giving up the whole self to the divine. To me, says Krishna, few lines below, he must sit firm in yoga, wholly given up to me. This sit is obviously not a posture. It is like we use the word stand. You must stand up for truth. Doesn't mean physically you stand. Sit is that sit tight over your impulses. Sit, that's the asana. Sit, but with your mind devoted eternally to me. And then finally gives all the signs of such a man. So first sign he gives, page 102, is equality. And he says there is no outward sign. Sri Aurobindo says it very clearly, 102. Arjun, voicing the average human mind, asks for some outward, physical, practically discernible sign of this great samadhi. How does such a man speak? How sit? How walk? No such signs can be given. Nor does the teacher attempt to supply them. He doesn't say he speaks only Sanskrit. He may speak French, for all you know. But we want only Sanskrit. We are very happy when we see mother has written Isha Upanishad in Sanskrit. If she didn't write, will it make a difference? She is the divine mother. How does it make a difference? So this is where we look for outward signs, because we are conditioned. Oh, yogi must walk like this. Nowadays, sign of a yogi must come with a fanfare. Otherwise, he's not a yogi. There must be some people following him, some, you know, doing it after. So there is no such sign. For the only possible test of its position is inward. And that there are plenty of hostile psychological forces to apply. Why is using the word hostile psychological forces? Don't try to test a yogi. Who is really in yoga, he has overcome them. He has applied himself on these and conquered them. And what are those? He describes equality. Vitaraga bhaya krodha, hani labho, jaya jayo. A man with mind untroubled by sorrows, who has done with desire for pleasures, from whom liking and wrath and fear have passed away, such is the sage whose understanding has become founded in stability. Don't try to test by seeing whether he is afraid or whether he is angry. You know, somebody in the ashram, now of course a grown-up person, would test the mother when she is sitting by pinching her toe to see whether she is having pain or not. Because divine is supposed to be beyond pain when she is taking the class. And he's testing. Everybody says she's divine. Let me see. And mother is quiet, continuing with the class, not saying a word. But people nearby, you know, are feeling bad. Mother disclosed that he is trying to test me after 15 days. When somebody asked her, then someone had the wisdom to tell the boy, you have tested, no. Now you can leave it. But mother didn't say. Untroubled by sorrows. Look at Sri Aurobindo and the mother, their lives. Look at even Sri Krishna, losing his near and dear ones. That is the sign of a yogi. Yogi is not somebody who is outwardly leaving things. He is inwardly free. So what is the advice? We come toward the end. And yet he does not cease from work and action. So page 103. Fixed in yoga, do thy actions, which evidently mean this yoga is not about sitting in meditation in a posture, because you have to do actions. Very few actions you can do sitting. No, you have to walk, you have to do things outwardly. Fixed in yoga, do thy actions, having abandoned attachment. having become equal in failure and success, and there will be abundant quota in everybody's life. Why? Because these are the hostile fellows trying to, oh, you want to do yoga? Okay. I'll see. I'll make you fail. You say, you can't make me fail because I am not doing it for this. I am doing it for my union with the divine, in which there is no failure. There is only a constant moving towards him. That these fellows don't understand. They want to show us our weakness, show us where we are. No, no. Everything we can turn toward the divine. Failure is cradled on thy deathless arms. Victory is thy passage mirrored through fortune's glass. So this is the state of the yogin. Having become equal in failure and success, for it is equality that is meant by yoga. And then he says, action is distressed by the choice between a relative good and evil, the fear of sin and the difficult endeavor towards virtue. But the liberated who has united his reason and will with the divine cast away from him, even here in this world of dualities, both good doing and evil doing. For he rises to a higher law beyond good and evil, founded in the liberty of self-knowledge. So this is what he is saying. And when he is in that state, then what happens is, yoga karmashu kausalam. Spontaneously all that he does is an expression of the divine flowing through such a person. And therefore the action is perfect. Not that I have to do this outward action perfectly and I am eyeing upon, oh, people will say how well I have done. People will say that, look, I am so humble. No. That perfection will come when we are in yoga. It's the other way around. Of course, we should do things well. That's not the point. But if you are in yoga, action done in yoga is not only the highest, but the wisest, the most potent and efficient, even for the affairs of the world. For it is informed by the knowledge and the will of the master of works. Yoga is skill in works. That's how it is skill in works. Not outwardly, your inner state will make it perfect. Because now the divine will take up the work. And can we imagine this? A limitless possibility. The sages who do works without desire for fruits and in yoga with the divine are liberated from the bondage of birth and reach that other perfect status in which there are none of the maladies which afflict the mind and life or a suffering humanity. The status he reaches is the Brahmic condition. He gets to firm standing in the Brahman, Brahmi sthiti. And what is that Brahmi sthiti? There is a whole reversal. Mother speaks about the reversal. What is reverse? The whole view, experience, knowledge, values, seeings of earthbound creatures. So how it is reversed? He says, Yanisha sarva bhutanam tasya jagrati sayami. So he says that in which everybody is asleep, that to which everybody is asleep, to that the wise one is awake. And that in which men are awake and take pleasure, that is a night to the yogin. He is asleep toward those things. That is the sign. This life of the dualities, which is to them their day, their waking, their consciousness, their bright condition of activity and knowledge, we may use that their topics of debate and discussion, is to him a night, a troubled sleep and darkness of the soul. That higher being which is to them a night, a sleep in which all knowledge and will cease, is to the self-mastering sage his waking, his luminous day of true being, knowledge and power. So this is the sign which is inward. And finally he says, last line, yet ever motionless, they are troubled and muddy waters, disturbed by every little inrush of desire. They means those who are intelligence and will is turned outward. But what about yogi? The yogin, karma yogin, he is an ocean of white being and consciousness, which is ever being filled, yet ever motionless in its large poise of his soul. So many things are coming in his consciousness. It becomes vast as the ocean. Look at how many people, mothers, just life, mother and Shubhendra's life. You will say only divine can handle this. From morning till night, Shubhendra writing letters, replying, doing so many things. Only the divine can do it. So many things are coming into him. Yet ever motionless in its large poise of his soul, all the desires of the world enter into him as waters into the sea. Yet he has no desire nor is troubled. For while they are filled with the troubling sense of ego and mine and thine, he is one with the oneself in all and has no I or mine. He acts as others. So outwardly, he is doing all the actions that everybody else is doing. He acts as others, but he has abandoned all desires and their longings. He attains to the great peace and is not bewildered by the shows of things. He has extinguished his individual ego in the One, lives in that unity, and fixed in that status at his end, can attain to extinction in the Brahman, Nirvana. And this is not a negative self-annihilation of the Buddhism, but the great emergence of the separate personal self into the vast reality of the One, infinite, impersonal existence. So, and this is only a beginning. Many would take it is end. You have arrived at Brahman Nirvana. What else you want? 4-5 things, simple, practice it, end of the story. But Sri Krishna, once the divine begins to lead us, he will not stop short of the complete truth. And that is what we will see through the rest of the chapters of the Gita.